This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk about the 6th District Congressional race with the candidate who has raised the most money thus far, Republican Garrett Graves. He will qualify tomorrow, presumably, to be a candidate in the race to succeed Bill Cassidy on Capitol Hill, representing the greater Baton Rouge area. We'll talk with Garrett Graves and why he has entered the arena. Also, later in the hour, Dan Moldea, perhaps the best investigative reporter in America, the man who blew the lid on the scandals that enveloped Bob Livingston in 1998 and David Vitter in 2007. He'll talk about his long career and why it was Larry Flint who hired him to break these stories. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. That's your number locally. And if you're dialing outside the area, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org online. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and our leadoff guest is Garrett Graves, who is a candidate for the 6th District congressional seat being vacated by Congressman Bill Cassidy, of course, is running for the United States Senate and is having a fervent campaign against Mary Landrieu. Garrett Graves was chair of the Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority under Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana. Good morning to you, Garrett Graves.
Good morning, Jim. Great to be back.
On the 68th birthday of William Jefferson Clinton, 42nd president of the United States, did you like him?
I thought that President Clinton was a great communicator, and I think that he was able to do a good job connecting with people overall in regard to, I think, ideology. I didn't agree with a lot of the decisions that he made, but I do think that he was a very effective communicator, and I think that he tried to listen to the people a lot better than the current president.
What did you not agree with him on?
I think that there were some, in particular, I remember working on some of the offshore energy revenue sharing legislation where we were trying to share some of the offshore energy revenues from oil and gas production in the coastal area. We were trying to start some coastal projects. We were trying to start some infrastructure projects, road projects. And I remember repeatedly running into brick walls with that White House. And those were some of the issues that come to mind right off the bat, where I think that they really just missed the boat or missed opportunities to make good progress.
The economy did well during his 8 years. Does he get any credit for that? Or
look, I'm not going to sit here and say he was the worst president that we've ever had. I think we've hit new lows to some degree in regard to what's happening now under mm-hmm. under this president, but. But I definitely, again, I think that there are things that President Clinton could have done better in regard to Louisiana's priorities.
What about the last two presidents, George Bush and Barack Obama? Your thoughts about them?
George Bush, I think when you hear him speak in regard to ideology, I think that President Bush ideologically, with the exception of some foreign policy issues, I think that he was very well connected with Louisiana. In regard to implementation, I don't think that President Bush did a phenomenal job at all. And I think a lot of that had to do with some of the people that were around him and some of their experience and their ability to implement. President Obama, you know, it's great to see people who are good speakers, and I think he can rile up a crowd. He can get people motivated, and I think especially after his first election is evidence of that. I think that this president, despite what he may see as good intentions, I think just very out of touch with Louisiana. I mean, probably, at least in my lifetime, the most out of touch with Louisiana in regard to any president, and just become, I think, ineffective. It has been fascinating to see this president repeatedly take unilateral actions and what I believe is largely circumvent the Constitution in regard to the balance of powers, the role of Congress, the role of the White House, being able to take administrative actions and executive orders as opposed to following, you know, the process that you're supposed to when Congress is supposed to pass laws and the president's supposed to sign them. That being said, I will also acknowledge that I think this Congress has been incredibly dysfunctional in regard to their ability to get along and get things done, which has certainly contributed to some of the dysfunction we're seeing coming out of Washington.
The election is 11 weeks from today. Qualifying starts tomorrow, and Garrett Graves will be, I imagine, you'll be first up. You'll be there early in the morning qualifying, won't you?
We will. We will. Qualifying's Wednesday through Friday, and we're excited to move to the next phase of the campaign and really get moving toward the sprint here.
Have you always been a Republican?
I have. A lifelong registered Republican.
And why did you choose to be a Republican at an early age?
Yeah, you know, certainly in the era of Reagan, who I just think was one of our phenomenal presidents, and especially in recent times, very inspiring president. I think that he was once again I acknowledged earlier that President Clinton, I think, was a very good communicator. I think that Ronald Reagan was a phenomenal communicator, did a great job connecting with people, great job explaining why he felt certain ways, why he was pushing certain initiatives, and I was very inspired by him.
297-5633, please be brief in your remarks, and we'll take some questions, and of course, yours truly will ask a few more of Garrett Graves, candidate for Congress in the 6th Congressional District and a native of Baton Rouge. It's Josh downtown. Josh, good morning. You're on with Garrett.
Good morning, Jim. My question is regarding our horrible traffic conditions here in the Capital Region. So what could and what would Garrett do if he is elected to help alleviate some of our current and our growing traffic issues?
Traffic?
Yeah, Josh, thank you. I think that is absolutely one of the top priorities that we need to be addressing. When you look at the traffic in Baton Rouge, in West Baton Rouge, Iberville, Ascension, Livingston, the statistic alone speaks for itself. The worst traffic in the nation for a city of its size. We are at least 30 years behind transportation planning and improving the roads and infrastructure in this area. One of the first things I want to do is work together with the parishes in this region, with the State Department of Transportation and Development, and come up with a plan. You know, you've talked about the bypass, the loop, and all these different solutions. And, of course, everyone finds a problem and with a solution that's put on the table, and nothing moves forward. But what's happening right now is we're literally beginning to freeze this region's economy. It's great to have these huge economic development projects and these huge wins in regard to employment opportunities or jobs, but if people can't get there, then that's really a loss. So we've got to come around, we've got to begin to develop consensus, and we've got to rally behind a solution in terms of what we're going to do to get traffic through Baton Rouge, to get traffic around Baton Rouge, to try and take advantage of some of the existing capacities on the Audubon Bridge, Sunshine Bridge, Old Mississippi River Bridge, and we need to be looking long. We need to be looking at a new crossing of the Mississippi River, which ultimately is one of the big bottlenecks, the approaches and the Mississippi River crossing.
297-5633. Here's a question online at inkstershow@wrkf.org from Robert Miller. He says, is global warming a hoax, as many in the GOP claim, or is it a real problem caused by humans through pollution?
You know, Robert, it's an interesting issue lately. The reality is that the climate has always changed. Before people were even around on this earth, you had extraordinary changes in terms of ice age and little ice age and other types of changes that have occurred, again, both since people have been on this planet and before. And so I think the climate has always changed. The climate will continue to change. It is a dynamic climate. And one of the things that we need to focus on is we need to focus on some of the changes. If we're going to sit here and ignore the fact that the climate has always changed, and we're going to ignore the fact that you can go out there year to year and you can measure sea rise in coastal Louisiana, and, you know, very small scale, but we have to take that in consideration. For example, into our hurricane vulnerability in the communities and businesses in South Louisiana. If we're going to stick our head in the sand and pretend like those things aren't happening, that's ignorant. And so, for example, when I was working on hurricane protection and coastal restoration projects, we would always take into consideration both the subsidence, which is the sinking or settling of land, and the sea rise, and take those two numbers and prepare for those moving forward. So that way your levee would continue to protect communities, your coastal restoration project would continue to be around. We need to stay focused on that and not sit here and fight all the time about causes and attribution. We need to focus on the symptoms. We need to focus on the changes we've seen in the past, and we need to prepare ourselves for the future.
But do you think that global warming is in part caused by humans?
I think that when you look at studies, there is absolutely some attribution of the greenhouse gas concentrations in the environment from humans. I mean, without a doubt. But the question in this case is, is the preponderance of that, is the majority of those concentrations attributable to anthropogenic or human causes? And no, I don't think so. I don't think that the majority of concentrations that are in the environment are attributable to humans. I think when you look back historically, you've seen wide variations in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. And I think especially when you look at the economic consequences of some of the solutions that have been put forth, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars or potentially even trillions of dollars over the long term in consequences to the global economy. And you know, the irony is when you look at states like California that stepped out, or some countries in the EU that stepped out and tried to impose these cap and trade programs, you now see the regret where folks are trying to walk away from those, quote, solutions.
All right, here's a question from Delia. How would Garrett explain a jump in CO2 in the atmosphere from 310 ppm in the late 1950s when it was first measured to 400 ppm today?
Well, I'll just go back and point to my earlier comments. I mean, I said before that I think that there is an attribution to anthropogenic causes. However, I also think that when you look back and you do ice core samples and others, you can see wide variations in greenhouse gas concentrations dating back well before present time. And so to suggest that all of the changes in climate today are attributable to humans is, I think, ignorant of what science shows historically.
Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica. You're on with Garrett Graves.
Hi. You stated your admiration for President Reagan. Well, Governor Reagan legalized abortion in the state of California, and in Louisiana, we're doing lots of things to limit female choice. Do you think Governor Reagan was on the right side of history?
You know, again, I'll go back and certainly give many accolades to President Reagan. I think that he did a phenomenal job as president, a great leader. And I think we could use some of those leadership skills today in this country. In regard to
the choice
pro-life
issue.
I'll just say that this state is solidly pro-life. That I am personally solidly pro-life. I grew up in a large Catholic family, and I believe that. It's not our decision to decide who lives and dies along those lines. I just think it's inappropriate.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Garrett Graves. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yes, so Mr. Graves, should coastal restoration be paid for by the oil companies or by the taxpayers?
What about the lawsuit? Was that a good thing?
I think the lawsuit is an awful idea, and I'll go back and answer Dan's questions and Jim your question as well. Dan, thanks for the question. You know, when you look at the coast of Louisiana, the fact that we've lost 1,900 square miles, that's the equivalent of the state of Delaware, nearly it's the state of Rhode Island, or nearly the size of Delaware, an extraordinary land area that has been lost. And folks, I think for many years looked at it as sort of like a birds and fish problem, an environmental problem, versus something that truly affects everyone in this state and to some degree this country. Hurricane Katrina really, I think, was proof that this isn't just a local issue, a parochial issue, or an environmental issue.
All right, hold that thought. Sure. We shall return in 90 seconds with Garrett Graves. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Congressional candidate Garrett Graves is with us, native of Baton Rouge, and he will qualify to run in the 6th District tomorrow. He was chairman of the Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority for 6 years under Governor Bobby Jindal. Will you be running with the governor's support?
I haven't asked the governor for his support. Certainly that was one of many jobs that I did over my career and working. I also had the opportunity to spend many years working in our family small business. Also worked up in Congress for the Louisiana delegation and served as a consultant and other jobs. And so, kind of trying to take all of those different experiences and help shape the campaign and candidacy.
All right. Andy Batson asks, how would you propose paying for fixing all of our problems?
Andy, it's a really good point. It's easy to sit on a campaign and go out there and make all sorts of campaign promises. And at the end of the day, you can promise up to $1 trillion worth of things and not ever have to follow through on them. But I think that the experience that I've had over the years and the various jobs and career that I've had, I've learned a lot about how to improve efficiency of organizations. And to give you an example, when I came and started working for the state years ago, I sat down and we had 6 different agencies that were tripping over each other in terms of redundant or duplicative capabilities. And so I sat down and said, all right, here's the plan. We're going to go ahead and take this mission, this budget, these people, or what have you, different components of different agencies, and streamline them. We ended up increasing productivity over 500% just by reorganizing government. So I think we can do the same thing at the federal level. The federal government today is trying to do too much. To some degree, it's trying to serve as a surrogate for families, for community, for churches, and for schools. And we've got to stop doing that. We've got to get back to the core competencies of government. And I think we'll have plenty of money to balance the budget and plenty of money to address some of these other higher priorities.
Any additional taxes off the table?
Jim, I'll tell you, I don't think we need them. I don't. I don't think we need them. I think that there's so much excess in government today. And look, I've worked with probably 15 different federal agencies over the mm-hmm. years. I've seen the excesses firsthand. I've got ideas on how to improve efficiency, and I'm looking forward to getting there and doing it.
Carrie Abair writes, is there anyone in the Democratic Party that you admire?
Oh, absolutely. I actually spent time working for John Breaux. I think that Senator Breaux was able to, he was one of those guys that I think the U.S. Senate could use in some capacity today in terms of being able to bridge Republicans and Democrats. Look, it's easy to stand on the sidelines and throw rocks at the person in the middle trying to propose ideas and make progress. What actually takes skills, what takes diplomacy is someone who can step in and figure out, okay, where's the middle ground and actually do something. And Breaux did a good job at that.
We're hearing the voice of Garrett Graves, who certainly looks the part as a congressman, but you've got to convince the people that you have what it takes. And obviously it's apparent that you're a very conservative individual. Mike Wolf asks the question, what is your position on amending the federal controlled substances law?
I'm curious in what way.
Well, would you be in favor of, for example, of legalization of marijuana?
Marijuana, along with various drugs, including painkillers, narcotics, and others, I think that those decisions are best. Let me say it this way. In regard to marijuana specifically, I'll say that I understand that there are processes by which they can remove the chemical that provides the, I guess, relieving component chemical, and you don't have to have it in a smoking form. They could do it in a pill form, and understand that progress is being made mm-hmm. there. So it seems like that might be a better way to go. But I think that drugs in general, I've seen huge problems within families. I've seen crime. I've seen incredibly bright people's lives be thrown away as a result. And we have to be very careful. I think that that we do need to have regulation, strong regulation of drugs. And I think that, that largely decisions need to be left up to the medical community. But I'm not a fan of going in and legalizing drugs. I just don't think it's a good idea.
Today, Section A, New York Times, fight on Common Core dividing Louisiana. Your position on Common Core.
You know, I think it's great that people are so engaged in education, and this has become such a front page or hot topic. But I'll tell you one thing. You know, I'm a father of three young kids, and my concern in what's going on in this fight right now is the kids are the ones who are being lost in this argument. You know, that my understanding of what the objective of Common Core was. The objective of Common Core is to improve our schools and improve the proficiency of our students. I don't think there's anybody out there in your listening world, anybody out there in the state who would oppose either one of those objectives. Now, in regard to Common Core, things have been brought up, like the curriculum being age inappropriate, the control of the curriculum and control at the parent and teacher and school district level, and things like privacy. Those are legitimate concerns. If those concerns are applicable in this case, let's get in there and fix them. Let's not go out there and file lawsuits. Let's not go fight over each other. Go back to the point that all of us support the objective of improving the proficiency of our students and improving our schools. We need to stay focused on those goals, and all these fights that are going on out there aren't helping the kids. Let's get back and focus on the kids, and let's help improve their future and their education.
So as it is now, you're not an advocate of Common Core?
What we need to do is I think we need to sit down on the three issues, that are the three primary issues that have been brought up. The control, which we need to have local control, and we need to get out there and we need to improve, I think, the understanding, and I think we need to ensure that we have local parent and teacher control and school district control. We need to make sure that kids' privacy, look, there's no reason for the federal government to be collecting privacy or information about the students. That's none of their business.
All right. Let's
fix those things that are the challenges and that the anti-Common Core folks are concerned about, and let's try and focus on the objectives that the pro-Common Core folks have talked about as being the objectives, which is improving the proficiency of our students and improving our schools.
All right. Question from Morris. Your thoughts about the fairness ordinance that the Metro Council shot down last week?
You know, I didn't actually read the fairness ordinance itself. I'll tell you that I think that anything that would actually elevate the status of any particular person, I think it's inappropriate. I think that everyone deserves respect. I think that we certainly should not be out there, you know, carrying out assaults on anyone or offending or discriminating in any way, shape, or form. But I don't think that we should step in and attempt to elevate the status of any particular individual group or anything along those lines.
So you think the Metro Council made the right call?
I'll say again that I didn't actually read the ordinance, and so I don't want to misspeak because I didn't read it. I'm happy to read it and get back to you and tell you what I think of it. But I think it would be a mistake to elevate the status of anyone.
Right. Miles in New Orleans. Miles, good morning. You're on the air with Garrett Graves.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks, Garrett. You know, you've worked in government for the bulk of your career. So coming from someone who works in the Baton Rouge area, how can you, get to know about the needs of businesses both in the 6th District and across the country?
Yeah, thanks, Miles. It's interesting. So first of all, I did spend several years, in fact, well over a decade working in family business, family small business. I'm doing consulting work. So I've spent a good bit of time in my life working in the private sector. But more importantly, you know, in regard to this job, in regard to being your representative in Congress, you can go out there to the public and you can go talk to folks in the construction business. They can tell you what the problems are. You can go talk to people in the real estate business. You can talk to people who are small business owners. They can tell you what the problems are. Your job in Congress is to actually make improvements, to make the change. So people come to you and they say, hey, look, I'm having this problem in my industry. Your job as a congressman or as a representative is to fix that problem. That's what I'm especially good at. Well, I will tell you that I think that I am an expert, and I think that Congress would largely say the same thing. I've been an expert witness to the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House on things such as energy, environment, infrastructure, transportation, and other things. I've spent a lot of time working on defense, foreign affairs, and other categories. I think I have a lot of expertise in those categories and others. Ultimately, your job in Congress is getting things done. And so you're not going to find anyone who is an expert in every single issue across the board to elect to Congress. What you need is someone who can be a difference maker, someone who can affect change. And I think that's what actually makes our campaign unique compared to the others.
All right. Alexa in Bocage. Alexa, good morning. You're on the air with Garrett Graves.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I'm a college student at LSU, and I've read that you don't hold an academic degree from a higher institution of education. Do you think that you'll be able to represent the 6th District as well or better than Dr. Bill Cassidy? And if so, why?
Sure. Thank you. And I want to be clear that I've been very clear on that, been very upfront on that over the years and publicly discussed it in numerous occasions. I went to 4.5 years in college. I spent several years working in the U.S. Congress. What happened is I got an internship, and I was asked to do an internship for 1 month, and they asked me to stay on staff. I had a long discussion with my professors and decided to transfer from Louisiana Tech to the American University in D.C. I was juggling school and work at the same time, and a combination of the fact that they didn't have a civil engineering program there at night where I was working, pursuing that civil engineering degree, and the fact that I was working in the expense, after discussion with my professors, decided to keep working in the Congress and the U.S. Senate. And I'll tell you that the experience I got in working up there, I'd put it against any Ivy League institution. I think something that's really important, you can look at President Obama, for example, who has a law degree from Harvard. I don't think he's been a good president. And so I don't think that that's necessarily a metric that you have to use to determine folks' qualifications. I think more important in regard to our candidacy is looking at the accomplishments. I'll put my record and I'll put my accomplishments up against anyone. And I'll say again, I think that that's why the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate have asked me to come testify on issues. I think that's why schools like Harvard have asked me to come speak to their students. I think that's why I've taught CLEs and other continuing education experiences for lawyers, engineers, and other professionals. So what's important, I think, is looking back at record, looking back at accomplishments, and looking back at the skills that I think are and experience that our candidacy brings to the table. And I think my record's clear, and I'm happy to put it up against anyone's.
Randy downtown. Randy, good morning. You're on with Garrett Graves.
Yes, good morning. I was calling to ask Garrett about the Comeet flood control project, which really seems to be going nowhere.
All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. Wow, Randy, that one has been incredibly frustrating. I think it's an example of some of the dysfunction in Washington. The fact that you have a project that has been out there for 20 plus years, that very little progress has been made, despite the fact that you have been paying a tax or a millage in to advance this project. I started working with Senator Bodie White and Representative Valerie Hodges and Senator David Vitter and others because this project was a complete logjam. The Corps of Engineers was trying to take hundreds of acres of private property from unwilling sellers, people like homeowners, camp owners, and others that didn't want to sell their property. Whenever the Corps could have taken property from willing sellers anywhere from Mississippi to Lake Maurepas. So we sat down and we worked out a solution. And I'll tell you, we finally broke the logjam. We got the Corps of Engineers to finally apply some common sense to the situation. That project, once a new mitigation solution is developed, and I know the State Department of Transportation, Chris Knott's a great guy over there, is working on it, and also the Amiot River Basin Commission is working on coming up with those mitigation solutions. As soon as they do, there's $16 million in the bank. That project should take back off again. But I will say that we need the federal government back at the table and putting some money into this project. Because since, I believe, since Congressman Richard Baker was representing this region in Washington, I don't know that additional federal dollars have come to the table.
Well, Garrett, we wish you well. And certainly you're a formidable candidate and may very well be in a runoff with Governor Edwin Edwards. But you're going to have a lot of company on the Republican side. And some rather prominent people, including Dan Clater, Paul Dietzel, Lenar Whitney, and others. And it should be fun in the next 11 weeks.
Thanks, Jim. Great being here. Appreciate all the diverse questions. And more information, it's garret2014.com.
That's with one T, right?
One T.
One T. Thank you, Garrett. Take care.
Right. Thanks, Jim.
See you soon. Bye. Dan Moldea is with us, perhaps the top investigative reporter in the United States, a man who has been on the trail of the mafia, has investigated the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy and wrote a best-selling book related to that, has investigated the mob in the NFL, and he is the reporter who blew the lid off the scandals that enveloped David Vitter in 2007 and Bob Livingston in 1998. Joining us from Washington, Dan Moldea. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning to you. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing well. And you've written about your life and times. The book is Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer. That's Guerrilla, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A. It's a fascinating, yes. Fascinating ride.
It has been. I have to say, though, I have nothing against the first district, congressional district of Louisiana. I love Louisiana. And, the fact that I went after both Bob Livingston and David Vitter, his successor, in the first district was by sheer coincidence.
How did you happen upon the Bob Livingston story in 1998 when he was on the brink of being the Speaker of the United States House?
As I recall, what happened was, and I go into this considerable detail about this in the book, Newt Gingrich had been pushed out of the speakership, and support rallied around Bob Livingston. This was in the midst of the impeachment process, as everyone who's of age recalls, and it was during a process when the Monica Lewinsky thing was happening. It looked like it was moving towards impeachment. But there were people in Congress who wanted censorship. They wanted the president to be censured. But then there were those who wanted to go for the gold, to go for the whole Megillah, to go for impeachment, removal from office, the whole thing. And one of them was Bob Livingston. And when he became Speaker Designate and indicated his preference to go for the gold on this, Larry Flynt had put, the porn king, had put $1 million reward up for evidence of people who were in Congress who had conflicting standards of private behavior for public officials, one for those they like and another one for those they don't like. And so they accumulated, I think about 2,000 calls, I think, came in, but it came down to about 40 leads. And then they needed an investigator to run the leads, and so I was contacted and asked if I was interested in doing this. And by this time, I'd pretty much taken sides on the Clinton scandals. I had written a book on the suicide of Vincent Foster, the former deputy White House counsel, which was being portrayed by some in the media, in the conservative media particularly, as being a murder that was orchestrated by the Clintons, or that the Clintons were part of a cover-up of that murder, as they called it. And then there were congressional committee hearings, and to me it was an attempt to undermine the authority of the Clinton White House. Anyways, I was already there, and then once the Lewinsky scandal broke, Ken Starr's office started making what was alleged to have been illegal leaks to selected reporters in the media. And I had also discovered information about that, and then I leaped into the leak scandal as well. So I already had a considerable amount of background on this situation.
All right, we're going to return with Dan Moldea, and we'll hear more about how he exposed Bob Livingston and David Vitter in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. If you'd like to engage Dan Moldea, as investigative reporters go, he's as good as it gets in this country. Robert Sherrill of the Washington Post says if Moldea were a prize fighter, he would be kind of a Rocky Graziano. He never, never quits punching. Moldea never relents. Now, the Livingston story, and to give the Cliff Notes version of this, a woman came forward about a relationship with the congressman,
I kind of dragged her out of the shadows. I had a source, and the source, I was a little uncomfortable with the source because the source had some connection to the Marcello gambling empire down there. and I knew a lot about Carlos Marcello. I was the journalist who also claimed that Marcello, a mafia guy named Santo Trafficani, and Jimmy Hoffa, the former president of the Teamsters, had arranged and executed the murder of the President Kennedy back in 1963. Anyway, I was uncomfortable with this source who knew of a woman with whom Livingston had some sort of a relationship. But through a complicated series of events and with the help of caller ID, I finally found this woman who wound up calling me. And she started telling me a story, which I found remarkable. And she was a person who I thought was a heroine, in effect, because she decided she was going to step forward. As I said, there was a reward up. She wasn't interested in any money or any payment. She was doing a good citizen thing. I have a lot of respect for her. And it was that conversation and subsequent conversations, especially the one on December 15th, 1998, that set the stage for what was about to happen. On December 17th, she called me that morning and said she had made a phone call. I thought I'd been double-crossed, and so I made a phone call, and then that's what set everything. My phone call was the phone call that set everything in motion, although it wasn't any. I've never revealed to whom that call went, but it wasn't anyone close to the president, his staff, his legal team, or anything like that. It was somebody a little peripheral to that. And then Livingston said that he had been Larry Flynted on the afternoon of December 17th. He appeared to have the full support of the Republican caucus. And then on December 19th, as the firestorm over Livingston brewed, before the impeachment of the president, and of course he was impeached, but before he was impeached, amidst a little bit of backdrop on this, there were already calls for his resignation. There were a couple of hundred newspapers that were calling for his resignation.
You're talking about like Clinton's resignation, yeah.
That's right. People were starting to call for his resignation, but when the facts about Livingston came out and the hypocrisy therein, people who were calling the president, say, a misogynist and were, in fact, engaging in somewhat reprehensible behavior themselves, as they would call what Clinton was doing, Livingston stood up and decided to resign, not only as Speaker Designate, but as a member of the House. Mm-hmm. And the president's popularity shot up to 73% that day as a result of that hypocrisy being understood by the Republican House. And the case, which was very strong, based on 10 stars of information, just limped to trial to the United States Senate, during which time I continued to do my work. I had 5 of the 13 House managers, the prosecutors in the Senate trial, on my list, and we were prepared to lower the boom on them as well.
All right. Well, Livingston, I don't want to get too much in the weeds on this, but Livingston resigned on the day he voted for Clinton's impeachment.
And right, on December 19th, right.
December 19th, 1998. And you've never revealed who it was he had the affair with, but you have revealed it was a lobbyist.
Right.
That's in the book, Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer. Why did Larry Flynt go easy on him?
I got to tell you, I thought that was a fairly remarkable thing. I was sent to, as soon as Livingston resigned, I insisted on being, kept quiet, that I was the person who pulled the trigger on this. And because I knew that there would be such an incredible blowback against me, which wound up happening after I was revealed later on, but Flynt brought me to Los Angeles, and while I was in his office, he had received a call from Bonnie Livingston, Bob Livingston's wife, very loyal, dear wife, who kind of pleaded with Larry to stop the investigation of her husband. And so Larry came in, and he said to me, he said, your investigation of Livingston, it stops now. And I said, wait a minute here. If you read what he said in the New York Times today, he said, you're going to get your just desserts. That's an exact quote. For what's happening. And he said, no. He says, it's over with regard to Livingston. Move on to the next target. Flynt showed a tremendous, I mean, we could be criticized for what we did, but showing restraint and compassion is something that we did show that restraint and compassion. And well, I give Flynt a lot of credit for that.
A little over 8 years later, you are the man who, exposed David Vitter as one who consorted with prostitutes. How did this happen?
I had there was a woman in Washington named Deborah Jean Palfrey, and she was known as the D.C. Madam. And she was really causing quite a ruckus in Washington because when her home was raided, the feds grabbed everything, seized everything, except for her phone records. And so there was, she had her phone records, and her lawyer grabbed the phone records, and he digitized them. But the judge in her case, she was under indictment for on federal conspiracy case, he put a protective order on the phone logs. ABC had gotten a hold of some of the pages before the protective order went on, and there was a discovery of some guy from the State Department and another guy who was one of the architects of the Iraq War, who was also a columnist for the Washington Times, who were in there, in that small section that ABC had had. Deborah Jean Palfrey asked me to write her memoir while she was under indictment, and so, you know, agreeing to do so, I, you know, her lawyer, he said, listen, I'm getting ready to send out the digitized versions of the phone list. And I said, you know, you're going to mail them? And he said, yeah. And I said, why don't you just give me one right now? Because you're going to mail one to me. So he gave me the disk, and I ran home, put the disk in. All I had was phone numbers. There were no names attached to the numbers or anything. And so what I had to do is I had to run a phone number in a reverse phone check. Remember, this is 2007 technology, which is considerably different from what it is today. And I had to run a reverse phone check on the number, and then names would come up, and then I would do research on the names. I mean, I had hundreds of guys here in Washington, and I, you know, I've had no intention of interfering with anybody's life who wasn't, you know, making a show out of somebody else's personal life and concealing their own. So most of the stuff, I mean, 99% of this stuff I threw in the shredder. But I was going along, and I found a number that I had not seen before. And I ran it, and David Vitter's name came up. And so I ran the number again on two other databases, and it was confirmed it was David Vitter's number. So I contacted Flint, and I said, I've got one. And he said, is he a hypocrite? And I said, wait till you see this guy, Larry. And that's what started the ball rolling from there. I had leaked the story to Time magazine, and then Vitter had received a call from Time to his office at the same time that Flint had called Vitter's office. So here's Vitter's office receiving within a 10-minute period of time, receiving a call from Time magazine and from Larry Flint's Hustler magazine. Hmm. And I just said to myself, that office must be in turmoil. And what Vitter did is he ran off to an AP reporter trying to get ahead of the story and to put his own spin on what had happened. And then the scandal broke from there. I mean, I have to tell you, this guy is you know, a Harvard graduate, a Rhodes Scholar, you know, stupid as a stone, as far as I'm concerned, for engaging in this secret life that he had, which goes far beyond what from what I had discovered, from what I understand. And he's managed to survive. It seems as though, as Ed Edwards would say, that the only thing that can completely destroy a politician in Louisiana was being caught with a dead girl or a live boy. Mm-hmm. And but in this particular case, Deborah Jean Palfrey wound up committing suicide after her conviction on conspiracy charges, which incidentally was the time I, as a mafia reporter, I've seen many, many conspiracy cases, but this is the first time I've ever seen a conspiracy of one. And so Jean kills herself, and guys like David Vitter, who should have been identified as unindicted co-conspirators in that conspiracy, walk free and have prospered ever since.
How many times did his phone number appear on the
list? Number came up five times, Jim. His number came up five times, and there were other allegations about a woman named Wendy Cortez. I really had nothing to do with that, although I was the one who set up the polygraph. Flynn called me and asked me to set up a polygraph test for her, so I found the best polygraph operator I knew of, and that was Ed Gelb from Los Angeles, who was the former president of the American Polygraph Association. And I asked him if he'd be willing to do this polygraph, which he did. And Cortez, from what I've been told, passed the polygraph with flying colors. And but apparently Vitter has really never really come to account from all of that. And from what I understand, it wasn't much of an issue during the 2010 campaign when he ran for re-election and surprisingly won, and not only won by some small margin, he won by a considerable amount. And I was shocked to see that he was running for governor in 2015. And if he loses that race, then he would just simply seek re-election to the Senate in 2016, I would assume.
When I was looking at the date that you found Vitter first calling the D.C. madam, 2-27-01, I noted that that was Mardi Gras Day. And,
right. It's also my birthday. That's why I stopped on that day, because it was my birthday. And Mardi Gras is an extra little irony, I think, to this.
Yeah, he's a Roman Catholic, and as am I, and perhaps he was getting this out of his system before the Lenten season.
Exactly, yes. And, you know, he was low-hanging fruit on this thing. Again, it was difficult because all we had were phone numbers. And then you have to run the numbers and then do checks on this. But, you know, basically that's what I did. I had spent days and days on this thing. And then once I got it, I put a package together for, as I say, Time Magazine. And then I leaked the story to a trusted reporter at Time Magazine. I didn't ask him for anything other than, here's the story. I'm spoon-feeding you the story. Do with it as you please. All we're asking for is credit for the discovery. And the reporter's a very honest guy, and he just went out and he did his work. There was no consultation with us or anything. He just did his own investigation and concluded that we were right and that Vitter had been mm-hmm. caught in this very nasty situation for a politician.
When people in academia review what happened to Vitter and to Livingston, they marvel that this story was not broken by the New York Times, not by the Wall Street Journal, not by the Baton Rouge Advocate or the New Orleans Picayune or the Louisiana Radio Network. It was broken by Larry Flint Productions and a guy named Dan Muldea. It would not have been broken without you, but why right. did Larry Flint have the chutzpah to do this when others in, quote, mainstream media organizations refrained from doing this kind of investigative
work? Well, they did. Jim, as you recall, you were very close to this as well. I mean, they did. They spent a year dealing with cigars and knee pads and Monica Lewinsky and everything else. They had no. There was this entire nookie patrol at Newsweek that was just running after the president's girlfriends and grabbing anything they could grab from, you know, such crazy websites as the Free Republic and these right-wing publications, which were putting out all this nonsense about Vince Foster's murder at the hand of the Clintons. And so, you know, what I decided to do was I decided to take sides, and that's why I call this, you know, this thing is a Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer. But, you know, guerrilla writer is, when that term was given to me, it was not a compliment. It was given to me by Stanhope Gould, who was a producer at NBC News when I was investigating the Jimmy Hoffa case in 1975. I was a kid then. I was 25 years old. And Stanhope Gould had heard about me, and he said, I heard you're the guerrilla writer who takes sides. And that was not a compliment. He was basically saying that I align myself with certain factions. And in the Teamsters case, I was aligning myself with the rank-and-file pro-union reformers who are trying to reform their union from the mafia control that it had. So I plead guilty today. I mean, I as a guerrilla writer, as a reporter who takes sides, you know, I plead guilty to the fact that I do take sides. And on this Clinton thing, I'd really never taken side politically before. This was, you know, something far off the beaten track for me. But again, when I saw what was happening to the Clintons, saw what was happening to the country as a result, I decided that this was important enough for me to risk being destroyed by getting involved in this thing, which I nearly was.
Well, you know, the
blowback from it.
The hypocrisy is what Larry Flint was going after.
I agree. Exactly. You're exactly right, Jim. That's exactly what it's about. Hypocrisy resonates with the American public. It's very hard to explain financial transactions and financial improprieties, but sex is something they understand. And when people who are investigating sex say this is not about sex, you can bet it's not about sex. When they say it's not about money, you can bet it's about money.
Right. Well, Bob Livingston, you write, had allowed his office to be the site location during the filming of a 1994 anti-Clinton video promoted by Jerry Falwell, which accused the president of drug trafficking and murder. Now,
exactly.
Bob Livingston's done very well since you outed him.
You know, I tell you, I have respect for Livingston in a very weird way. I have respect for Livingston. I talked to one of his staffers once who called me up just out of the clear blue and just wanted to talk to me about what had happened. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna show this guy respect and I'm gonna talk to him. And I heard some very kind things about Livingston, which I believed. Again, I was moved by what Bonnie Livingston had done on behalf of her husband. I thought that was an extraordinary thing for a wife to do, to call Larry Flint and to ask him for mercy on this.
Dan, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. But I certainly want to call on you again. You're a fascinating man. It's a great book, Confessions of a Guerrilla Writer. You can get it at Amazon.com. And Dan Moldea, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure talking to you.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.